This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm Paul Starobin, and welcome to America and Beyond of the New Books Network. My guest today is Tom Zollner. Tom is a fifth-generation Arizonan, a former staff writer for the Arizona Republic, and the author of 8 nonfiction books, including Island on Fire, which won the 2020 National Book Critics Circle Award. Welcome to America and Beyond, Tom.
Thank you. Good to be here, Paul.
We're talking today about your book, Rim to River, Looking into the Heart of Arizona. And tell us a little bit about what got you into this project. And also, I was just impressed with the sort of the physical aspects of this as somebody who grew up and has spent almost all of his life on the East Coast, except for some stints abroad. A place like Arizona can feel a little bit remote and exotic to me. So I think I found the physical aspect to be kind of an important part of what you were trying to deliver in this book, including in your own very personal voice.
So much is about perspective. And growing up in Arizona, it seemed anything but remote and exotic. And I didn't have a terribly comfortable childhood there. Thanks mainly to
unusual.
Yeah, indeed. No one's ever gone through that before. I attribute partly to kind of a geography of loneliness, the way that the automobile-driven patterns of our civic development centered on the detached ranch-style home, the shopping center, these big arterial roads, you know, 8 lanes of asphalt, and a dependence on newcomers to float the economy, a kind of a real estate industrial complex.
And when were you, not to date you exactly, but when were you born? What generation are you?
Sure, I was born in 1968. So
okay.
This is very much a 70s, 80s childhood, defined by shopping malls and automobiles, a lot of physical space. This is what the economy of large portions of the Southwest are built upon, is this dependence of newcomers.
Yes.
And of this crack cocaine of development. And while this is in some ways great because it does put people into houses, it does allow working and middle-class people to afford home ownership, it doesn't really foster a sense of the kind of geographies that create friendships and chance encounters. And so because of that, I grew up kind of lonely, kind of hating Arizona, to tell you the truth. and wanting to leave. And it was only in my early 30s that I came back to stay. I got a job at the statewide daily newspaper and covered it as a reporter. And I began to have my mind slowly changed. And I learned to embrace Arizona in spite of all its flaws, still arguing with those flaws.
Right.
And in 2019, I made the decision, you know, I gotta find out what's really going on here with this state and with my reactions to it, both love and dislike. And so I set out to walk across it.
Yes. And you describe in the book on September the 16th, 2019, I drove north from Tucson with my parents to the border with Utah in preparation to walk all the way down to Mexico, across the entirety of Arizona, top to bottom. And then you write, this book is an account of my pilgrimage towards the source of Arizona. And I circled the word pilgrimage because I highly recommend this book. You're a very careful writer, and pilgrimage has a great deal of resonance in literature. So in what sense did you consider it a pilgrimage?
Right. A secular pilgrimage to the place that gave Arizona its name. Scholars are certain about the etymology of 49 of our states, where they came from, whether it be a coinage like Florida from Spanish, a native origin, like, of course, Massachusetts, French, like Vermont. There's one place where there's a little bit of argument about the exact linguistic heritage of the name, and that's Arizona. And so the most convincing argument, one that I think more or less settles the case, only very recently by a historian who wrote in 2000, Don Garrata, the name is actually Basque in origin. Sure. And it came from a valley in what is now Sonora, Mexico.
Right.
The name means place of the good oak tree. It was the spot of a 1736 silver rush that lasted only a few weeks, but left its imprint on the consciousness of settlers in what is now northern Sonora, that the name Arizona, place of the good oak tree, you know, that means fabulous riches. It means tremendous opportunities. It means new frontiers. And then, of course, it was all gone in a few weeks. And some think it was actually a fraud, that the silver that people were chasing had been planted there as a kind of a scam. So right there in the name, you've got tremendous hope, and you've got disappointment, and you've got a sense of sleaziness. So many of today's aspects of Arizona can be found in that really strange origin story. And so what I wanted to do was walk across the entire state towards that valley, which is really hard to get to. It's not a park. There's nothing there to market. It's behind several sets of locked gates. A private family in Mexico now owns it. But that was my destination. That was the X on the treasure map.
But in principle, you could have just gone there or tried to go there without the expedition across the state. So that kind of gives another aspect to the journey or to the pilgrimage. And it's not my intention to do kind of a step-by-step sort of, you know, how you made your way across the state, but I do think it's important. Again, this is maybe my East Coast sensibility of just the rigors of just literally walking in this area. I mean, you know, water, food, all those things. You know, I went and spent about a week camping by myself outside of Los Alamos when I was down there. And I just, you know, got a small taste. I know that's not Arizona, it's New Mexico, but still, of just, you know, how different it was from my sort of New England, you know, sea coastal kind of experience. I mean, you were in for quite a bit. You lost a lot of weight, right?
Yeah, about 25 pounds.
Well, 25 pounds. You don't look to me to be an especially hefty kind of a person. So that's not a small percentage.
Well, Paul, we're all in dialogue with our environments. We all are having a constant conversation with whatever surrounds us. There's serious theological arguments as to whether or not we are separate from nature or a constituent part of nature. Mm-hmm. But regardless, there is a symbiosis that takes place, a kind of an exchange. And sometimes it's a happy kind of an arrangement. Other times we fight our environment.
Yeah, well, that actually sounds very transcendental, Thoreau or Emerson like, if I could speak for my New England compatriots.
There you go. And one of the most powerful metaphors for that kind of exchange, that dialogue that we're having, is to walk. And I think Thoreau, you mentioned him in his great essay Walking. Understood that this is an ambulatory conversation. And so I wanted, you know, that to be, first of all, a metaphor for how we exist in our environment, to simply fight for it, to walk across it, to go to physical extremities.
Yeah.
And
also by yourself. I mean, that's, which is also Thoreau-like, you know, not with a companion. I'm sure you could have found a companion.
All right. Asking someone, hey man, you want to spend
all right, you could have hired a
46
guide.
Days you know, walking 800 miles with the likes of me.
You could have hired a guide or somebody like that.
What a wimp out that would have been.
Well, no, all right.
That had to have been solitary.
Okay, had to be solitary. Did you have, by the way, what kind of writing implement did you take with yourself?
Pen and paper.
Good. A man
reporter's
after my
notebook,
heart.
As a matter of fact.
Excellent. Spiral notebook.
There you go.
The best.
The literature would grind to a halt without spiral notebook.
They survive combat. I know that.
I did not bring a word processor with me. Certainly.
Excellent.
Not.
Well, some people would. I mean, not to digress, but I mean, you could have, I don't know. Did you have like a GPS tracker or?
I did have a phone with GPS on it. Yes. And so, there were a few times that saved me from great trouble.
Yeah, and this is not my, you know, gloss. How could you? But how did you charge it?
That is a great question. First, I rigged up a solar charger to the top of my backpack, and that turned out to have been somewhat feeble, not for a lack of sunshine, but just, you know, our technology.
Yeah, those things never work.
Yeah, and when you're in motion, it doesn't really get
right,
the kind of charge that you need. So. I would just simply keep the phone off, except for times when I really, really needed it, and then charge up when I got to a place with electricity. There's also portable chargers that you can buy, like little cubes that the phone can plug into, but I tried to limit my use of those.
Right, right. And I mean, was there some point in this pilgrimage where you felt, as often occurs on pilgrimages, a sense of despair? Or if that's not... Well, treat us to that moment.
Oh, well, you know, the physical, and well, let me preface this actually by saying that I'm not a triathlete. I'm not even a very good hiker. This path can be done by those in average physical condition, which I think describes me. And when you are walking 20 to 30 miles a day with 35 pounds on your back, it's gonna at some point catch up with you in a really kind of pounding way. And that happened about 8 days in, after I had already gone up and down through the Grand Canyon, walking towards the city of Flagstaff, where I began to seize up like a car engine without motor oil.
Mm.
And, horrendous pains across the midsection. Very, very frustrating. And I raged at the sky. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I have you. I mean, it's at different points in the book, I have you, or you have yourself, sort of feeling sick about some things. I mean, you know, reaching that kind of level. But you persisted.
I don't know whether I had already committed to doing this, and that's sort of like burning the ships at Veracruz. Or just, you know, pure bullheadedness. I don't know what it was, but yeah, I mean, I told all my friends that I was going to do it. And if I said, you know, I had to catch a Greyhound bus and, you know, call it quits, that would have been just a mark of shame. So onward.
Right. Well, you sort of do see, and you know, this will be a little bit of a digression, but it's okay. I know recently you posted on your Facebook page that you were writing this piece about this kind of journey or expedition across a great number of casinos in Arizona, which I don't know how exactly that turned out, but you do seem to have this kind of appetite for sort of traversing the state and sampling its various and, you know, manifold, you know, aspects that you know, maybe wouldn't occur to everyone. Perhaps that's partly the journalist in you as well.
Yeah, you mentioned something that's not in the book, but I'll talk about it anyway.
Yeah,
it's for a forthcoming magazine piece.
Well, as whatever flavor you can give us, just that sure. Might fit into your overall sort of thinking about Arizona.
Sure. It's me and a crazy friend from Phoenix, an attorney, decided we were going to hit all 26 tribal casinos in Arizona within a 48-hour period and bet $100 in each one. And then after placing a single bet on blackjack of $100, walking away, win or lose, just to sort of see how we would fare financially, see if we could endure the 1,700-mile journey on virtually no sleep. And, you know, we did it. We made it our goal with 37 minutes to spare, and I emerged $200 the poorer.
That doesn't sound like much of a loss compared to what might have been.
Indeed. Statistically, it came out just about right as far as an expected rate of loss when you play what's called basic blackjack strategy.
Right. And you talk in the book as well about how the sort of gambling ethos is also part of the Arizona sort of experience and history. And we see that in people just as in Alaska, which I've observed myself, the kind of perpetual search for the various mother lodes that might exist, like in silver, for example.
That's very perceptive. Certainly many who moved to Arizona from 19th century miners, 20th century home seekers, those in our era, they are taking a big chance. They're rolling the dice on a landscape which doesn't always invite people in. It can be quite harsh. It can be in many places quite ugly. And certainly the political temperature in Arizona reflects some of that ugliness from time to time.
Yeah, we'll talk about that political temperature in a little bit, but I wanted to sort of, just more explore maybe more aspects of Arizona. One of the things, the book, I should also say, is also, it's not just about your the journey and the various places that it took you to, but you insert as chapters in that also kind of go back over your previous experiences in Arizona, including as a journalist. One of those chapters that caught my attention is called Hell's Gate, and it underscores this threat of violence that you also see is very much part of Arizona. Tell why that chapter for the book, and just give us some of the flavor of what what you were recording in that chapter.
Sure. The book is not only an account of a walk across Arizona, but it's 17 essays interspersed that deal with various facets of the state's history and culture. Copper mining, water, wildfires, border crossing, the history of the Arizona Republican Party, food, music. And the chapter that you mentioned is about our state's history of violence, which is written also into our DNA, along with that sense of gambling, along with that sense of seeking a fresh chance. The scarce resources lend themselves to fighting. The ghost of the Apache Wars, for example, lingers over the state. This is the longest American military campaign in our history. This was the U.S. Cavalry's attempt to pacify, quote unquote, the Apache and several other Native bands. And this was a long, dirty, ugly war. that lasted for longer than the United States was in Afghanistan, resulting in thousands of casualties, a lot of bitterness, a lot of unhappiness, an asymmetrical conflict, to be sure. But that that sense of Arizona entering the Union in a miasma of combat
mm-hmm.
has stayed with us. Our crime rates are higher than the norm. Our gun laws are quite permissive. Tempers flare in the summertime, and that lack of community that I mentioned up top, that certainly plays a role.
Yeah. And let me, in this, well, let me set up this chapter because I mean, I certainly found it arresting. You begin by saying, I walked out of my rented house in Scottsdale on the morning of April 10th, 2001, and squinted at a giant plume of smoke on the horizon. It was about 2 miles away and colored black, meaning that whatever was burning over there was still on fire. You knock on doors around the cul-de-sac. You learn who the property, the obliterated home, who whose property it was. And eventually, reporter-like, you come up with your, you know, sort of police beat type lead. Mary Fisher was shot in the back of the head and her children's throats were slashed in the hours before their Scottsdale home exploded Thursday, law enforcement sources said Friday. Well, I've also worked on local newspapers. I mean, yeah, that's kind of a story that you're not going to easily let go of. And in this case, it kind of led you on a sort of broader or longer expedition, right, to see what was behind it.
Right. I was working as a reporter for the Daily newspaper in Phoenix when that happened. The guy who did it, his name's Robert Fisher. He killed his wife and children and then disappeared. They turned up his vehicle up in a forested place called the Mogollon Rim several days later, and thought they had him cornered. I was up there as a reporter as the walls are closing in on him, but they never found him. Where did he go? Many of the detectives who worked on this case could never quite psychologically let go of this, and the case haunted them and still haunts them, and it haunts me. And so I took it on myself to go.
Haunts you in what sense?
Because the crime was so horrific and the mystery is so deep. Where did he go? Where is Robert Fisher? For many years, he was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. There is still no clue as to where he disappeared. I always felt like he walked deep into the Arizona forests and took his own life.
But you took, I mean, in this chat, you made some considerable effort to see if you could pin it down, right?
Yes. To play out my theory, to canvas, such as it were, that area and see if I could find any kind of sign of his remains. The animals would have scattered most of the cadaver within a couple of days, but I was hoping to find a rusted weapon of such that he would have taken his life by gunshot. So that forms the backbone of that chapter, talking about Arizona violence to try and find the remains of this mass murderer.
Well, how do you fit yourself or your into this picture as well? Because guns are certainly a theme in America and I suppose in Arizona. I don't know if the rate of gun ownership exceeds the national rate or not. But do you, I mean, for example, when you go deep into the woods or you go about, do you arm yourself?
I am a former gun owner and I gave it up because I believe the statistics which show that bringing a gun into the household is not ultimately useful for home defense, but rather makes your house more dangerous and you're liable to shoot yourself or shoot a family member.
Does that make you unusual, do you think, in Arizona?
I don't know. I mean, you know, we don't all have guns. I mean, let's be clear about that. But I don't think the ultimate futility of owning a weapon, that statistical reality has really entered the consciousness of those who choose to go that direction.
Yeah, because you read story again, this is sort of me on the East Coast about, I mean, gun laws in general becoming more permissive, more women arming themselves, you know, open carry. I mean, all that sort of stuff.
It makes what would have been an argument or a fist fight turn into a homicide. It exacerbates the damage from what might have been just hurt feelings or a minor injury. I think it's a pernicious thing in our society. I respect the right to have it for sporting purposes, but I think our Second Amendment is grossly abused.
Mm-hmm. What, I mean, we talked, referred earlier to this, the political temperature in Arizona, and I wanted to get to that. I mean, in what sense, how would you situate Arizona kind of in the national political conversation, and particularly with respect to Donald Trump? And if we could say that the Trump era in some way began with his, you know, ride down the golden escalator in the Trump Tower in 2015, can Arizona be understood as a place that in some ways anticipated Trump or a figure like him? I mean,
very much so.
Yeah. I mean, and I think a lot of people might, when they think of Arizona, think of two figures in particular, Barry Goldwater and John McCain. And just before you answer, the other thing I would say is that I was surprised when Trump, and this is back in 2015-16, Donald Trump went after John McCain pretty, you know, in a very slashing way, you know, criticizing his, you know, he's not really a war hero and stuff. And yet, that didn't seem to take him off the, the ballot for many people in Arizona.
Sure. You mentioned the golden escalator. I think there's a equally strong argument that the Trump candidacy really began in Arizona, because at the time of that golden escalator ride, he was regarded as a joke, written off. It took several weeks for that nativist message on the part of this fake billionaire to really penetrate the Republican base, who had been waiting for just such a figure as he to come along. And it was in Phoenix, actually, where he gave a rally that got an enormous amount of attention. The crowds were overflowing. It was the first time that CNN thought to cover it live.
Phoenix. So when?
Yeah,
that was before,
yeah.
Was before the Golden Escalator?
No, that was after the Golden Escalator.
Oh, after the Golden Escalator.
Right, but that's when he began to pick up momentum.
So I think still 2015, though.
Yes, 2015. What people forget what was that Trump was quite a marginal figure at the time of his announcement.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was kind of a joke. Was like, I wasn't sure he was even serious, but
it was a stunt.
Right.
It was only after that Phoenix rally where he railed against immigration even harder than he did with the Mexico's not sending us their best. That's when the wave began to catch. So I'm not blaming Arizona for creating Trump, but I am saying that is where the phenomena really began to take off.
Yeah, we're talking about the sort of the fertile soil.
The fertile soil.
So why was this? And the reason the soil was so fertile had to do mainly with the border issues. Is that what you're saying?
To a degree, I argued and have since the Gabrielle Giffords shooting in 2011 that the national discontents, the polarization, which is a widespread malaise, but that it began to be really fought out in a vicious way that involved bloodshed in Arizona, in the same way, Paul, that the Civil War, the U.S. Civil War of the 1860s, had a precursor in 1850s Kansas.
Bleeding Kansas, right.
Yeah, the off the charts invective that you heard over broadcast radio and television, the vilification of establishment figures, the embrace of wacky conspiracies. This was evident 6 or 7 years before Donald Trump came to Phoenix.
Why did people think they were fighting? I mean, in the not to push the parallel too hard, but in the Bleeding Kansas example, I mean, as I recall, you had this you know, the so-called popular sovereignty. There was this whole fight about whether, you know, the admission into the Union of a territory was going to be slavery or not slavery. So it was something very, you know, concrete and tangible that people understood that they were fighting about. I mean, what in Arizona at this time do you think people thought the what did they think the fight was over?
Well, I think it's the discontent over perceptions of a loss of economic hegemony, a sense that the quote-unquote elites are not looking out for them. Mm-hmm. The seizure of the microphone by those without a sense of a proportion or responsibility. I began to see these things in my home state before Trump monetized them.
Yeah.
To an extreme degree. And let me just say, I acknowledge the Bleeding Kansas metaphor is not perfect, but it's a way of expressing that large national disputes do have precursors.
Sure.
And so here's another factor that I think is important. It used to be said in post-World War II Arizona, this sort of lamenting phrase, refrigeration brings Republicans.
Mm. Refrigeration. I hadn't heard that one. Okay.
Yeah, that air conditioning that made the state.
Well, air conditioning, right? Golf courses
and semiconductor plants, aerospace. All these things brought migrants, internal migrants from the Midwest, bringing with them Midwestern Republican values. The Beau Idyll, of course, was represented by Barry Goldwater, and this was an optimistic vision. Goldwater ran a far sunnier campaign than is recalled.
I mean, actually, if you're going to mention, I think that's a good way to lead, flesh this out more. But I think we should, let's talk a little bit about who Goldwater was, because it's, even though Goldwater ran as a Republican and so did Trump, I mean, we're talking about very different kinds of Republicans, right?
Oh, yes, for sure. I mean, you see the antecedents of some of Trump in Goldwater, his basic laziness, his habit of dismissing complex problems with one-liners, his...
You're talking about Goldwater now or Trump?
We're talking about both of them. The way that both emerged from retail business context, which involved a lot of PR to the public. Barry Goldwater was heir to a department store fortune.
Right.
That's another factor that both are products of inherited wealth. I view Goldwater, I hope it's clear, in a lot kinder light than I do Donald Trump, because, you know, Goldwater was certainly on to something. But here's where this comes around, is because just as I argue that the Trump phenomena really took its wings in Arizona, the Trump presidency came to an end in Arizona when Fox News called it for Joe Biden.
Right.
Late on election eve. And that was the tipping of the dominoes as far as the public understanding that Trump is finished as a president. And just as refrigeration brought Republicans, just as internal migration changed Arizona from being run by a Democratic Party machine into a classic Sunbelt Republican state, so too, Paul, did internal migration changing Arizona, continues to change it into a Democratic state because of this influx from Colorado, from Nevada, from California, from Eastern states. These newcomers are mainly Democrats. The newcomers from international locations. You know, that's a complex picture, but you know, those are mainly Democrats. Even though,
right,
Latinos for Trump is an absolutely real thing that people have written off. All right, all this I mean to say is that, and I'm not trying to be too glib about this, but I think you should look at this, that Trump began as a national figure in Arizona, and his presidency, the wings began to fall off when Arizona turned against him.
Mm-hmm. Well, another element to this, which you, I mean, from the outside, at least, and perhaps it's a cliche, but Arizona is thought to be a good kind of breeding ground for political mavericks. And Goldwater was sometimes described in those terms. Certainly John McCain was described exactly in those terms. In fact, he seemed to embrace that label. And then we had the figure of Kyrsten Sinema, who perhaps, I'm sure you have your own perspective on her, could somehow occupy that space as well. But as we have recently seen, Sinema is, you know, she changed her designation in the U.S. Senate from Democrat to independent, even though she was still caucusing with the Democrats. And then more recently, she said that she was not going to run at all for re-election. So just a one-term senator. And that seems to have set up what is looks like, at least from the outside, as a more conventional type contest between a kind of a hard right type Republican and someone more from the progressive left in the Democratic Party. So is this kind of maverick element of Arizona politics being somewhat ironed out of the political fabric?
No, some of it is overblown. I don't think John McCain was, I think that maverick stuff was largely a result of campaign branding to make him more appealing to the center. You look at his voting record, it really was conventionally Republican. Certainly nothing out of that would have been out of place in the U.S. Senate at all prior to our current era.
Well, he did famously, though, to give the thumbs down to the repeal of Obamacare.
Yeah, but nevertheless, I mean, if occasionally breaking with your party or the zeitgeist of your party makes you a quote unquote maverick, then, you know, to me, okay. As I say, I think it's a little oversold.
Okay.
Sinema is a different story insofar as chasing, I think, a kind of a proximity to power and of behaving in really strange ways and absolutely turning her back on people who put her where she was, of refusing to take meetings, of being distant from the electorate, of thinking that she could play to independents who are a considerable force in Arizona while behaving in such insouciant, disrespectful ways towards those who would have tolerated a little deviance from orthodoxy, but could not tolerate her lack of seeming presence or seeming to care at all about her constituency.
Okay, so kind of in some ways a sort of idiosyncratic example. But just to put it,
she did not lose her seat. Let me just make this point, and then we can move on. Yeah. She did not lose her seat for being a quote unquote maverick. She lost her seat for being distant and out of touch.
Mm-hmm. Well, to kind of button up on the sort of this sort of explicitly political or electoral type conversation, I mean, are you saying with Arizona, but with the in-migration becoming somewhat more Democratic, and ending Trump's candidacy in 2020. So do you think that despite what the polls are now suggesting, that Trump would lose to Biden and will lose to Biden in 2024 in November?
I think the indications for Trump in Arizona are looking very bad. And this is, I don't think, just wishful thinking on my part.
Okay.
I think that the in-migration will only continue. I think there are lingering bad feelings among Republicans in Arizona towards the party regime that Trump attempted to put into place. I think his minion, losing gubernatorial candidate Kerry Lake, has alienated people within the Republican Party. I just also a considerable voting bloc in Arizona are Mormon women. Who are really, by and large, unhappy with Trump's lack of focus on what you might call traditional family values, with his patterns of lying.
Well, that's interesting because if that's their thinking, then you might expect that Christian evangelicals, and I have to say, I don't know offhand just how substantial the presence Christian evangelicals are in Arizona, that they have absolutely, for the most part at least, embraced Trump's candidacy despite those factors that you say are turning off the Mormon women.
Well, I say this as a believing Christian and one who goes to church. evangelicals, by and large, have sold out the Christian gospel for chasing after power and a desire to put to bed certain social issues that they view as some sort of existential threat to the United States. And it's been heartbreaking to watch.
But I mean, how, you know, we read quite a bit about Christian evangelicals in places like Texas and Alabama, but how about, what is their presence or their electoral significance in Arizona?
It is considerable. It does not have the 19th century roots of those other states that you mentioned. It's not precisely a generational thing in Arizona, and it does come from newcomers. By and large. However, you do get these groups with a Christian label on them. Turning Point USA, the youth mobilization group founded by Charlie Kirk, has taken on a much more evangelical flavor of late. But again, I emphasize this is not about the classic Christian virtues of the Book of Galatians, that is to say, kindness, charity, love, humbleness.
Right.
This is about cultural domination, and this is about beating back the sexual revolution, about beating back abortion rights, putting trans people back in the closet, that sort of thing.
Right. So, and by the way, we will finish with the politics, but do you think then that, you know, Carrie Lake is now running for senator? Do you expect that she'll lose as well for the same reasons
Trump might
go down?
Yes, Carrie Lake will lose decisively. Ruben Gallego, the Democratic candidate, is someone that Democrats just love, which is a military veteran, someone with a solid record in Congress, someone who doesn't go around lying their butt off. Carrie Lake is the opposite of all those, and has been a sycophant to Trump, has alienated members of her own party by wiretapping herself and then leaking the audio. It's a really embarrassing episode, which people can Google if they want to check it out. And I encourage that they do. Carrie Lake and wiretap or microphone, and you know.
I read a little bit about that.
It's a disgraceful scenario, and she deserves to lose bad. She deserves to lose badly.
I wanted to wrap up with the a discussion of the border, because it certainly has a significance in your book as well. And you are literally, just to remind, walking towards the border. And you begin by writing that the slant of Arizona's southern border, which gives the state the distinctive shape of a rocking chair, is an afterthought of the Mexican-American War, which I'm sure we all remember, right? The Mexican-American War, the Gadsden Treaty of 1853, signed 5 years after hostilities ended, put a land dispute to rest by running a surveyor's line along the 31st parallel until a spot not far from the present-day city of Nogales, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And then you describe the line, and you go on to say, and I think this is important, nobody gave this arbitrary border much credibility for decades. Citizens of both nations crossed it as a matter of daily business. The modern cult of death around, skipping ahead, the Arizona desert, however, began in 1994 with a national mood swing that turned against Mexican immigrants. A policy change called Operation Gatekeeper put the emphasis on urban crossing spots in San Diego, Nogales, and El Paso, and so forth. So you're kind of setting up your, which just your treatment of this important theme and topic, and which can bring us all the way certainly to the present, but beginning back in 1994. So, I mean, as a person who grew up in Arizona, I mean, you really had the proverbial bird's eye view of how this issue has evolved and morphed in various ways over the decades, to the point that now Americans in very faraway states, including, I believe, New Hampshire, even in polls anyway, list, you know, the border and everything that means as the number one issue in American politics.
Astonishing. The border is in a state of disarray, and I don't mean to downplay that at all. There are a panoply of folks crossing that never used to be part of the daily flow. People from the all over the global south, and so there does need to be a sense of good order, better administration, more clear ways for people to legally immigrate here. That's a phrase that I kind of bristle when I hear it from right wingers and these kind of border maniacs who say you got to immigrate here illegally. They have no clue just how difficult that is and mm-hmm. how messed up our system is for allowing that sort of normal immigration activity to occur. It is a disaster, and there hasn't been more resources poured into those courts, more resources poured into a humane way to handle this flow is an absolute disgrace. $30 billion wasted on a dumb solution, quote unquote solution, no solution at all, which was to build the wall. It's only it messed up the ecology down there, ruined migratory patterns. It's just a disgraceful waste. So there's no easy solutions to the border. You really have to go down there to see it. And for this chapter in this book, I spent time on something called the Devil's Highway, which is a 17th century road that goes from the top of the Sierra Cortez to San Diego.
17th century.
Yeah, 17th century, all the way to the 1600s. It's an astonishingly desolate place. You've not seen deserts like this before. Even longtime Arizonans are appalled by what they find down there in terms of the just the inhospitability of the landscape. And it became a place to write about this persistent, thorny, difficult issue of the border.
Which, I mean, again, from my outside eye, it seems like in some ways the perspective or the trend of things, the drift of things has really gone more in the way that Trump has defined the border. I mean, just recently we had, you know, the president, Joe Biden, lining up behind a border bill that ultimately failed to pass in Congress, failed to pass the Senate, but whose basic principles were worked out by one of the most conservative members of the Senate, and that seemed to represent, you know, had it been enacted, a kind of a sea change in our attitudes. So in another sense, Arizona also seems to have, you know, anticipated this issue.
Yes, that's I think that's prescient. This is certainly once again the pilot fish factor that you mentioned.
Pilot fish, yeah. It raises more questions. The metaphor, where in the pilot fish, I remember they're leading like the school of fish someplace.
Well, you know, if you want a preview for the coming attractions of national unhappiness, you know, just catch a flight to Arizona.
Well, I always, you know, if we can widen that prism a little bit, I always used to think of California that way, and probably because I grew up on the East Coast, I made it a point to spend some of my time as a journalist doing a lot of traveling in California, because it's sort of a cliche, but still, I mean, there's a great literature of California that has it as a kind of incubator of the American dream and the American experience and popular culture. More recently, I've thought of Texas in that way to some degree, and also Florida, even more recently, Florida, which now we're all talking, of course, about very large states. So I have to admit, it has not occurred to me to think in quite the same terms about Arizona as a pilot fish.
That's the case of part of the case of this book. And if I can maybe sell it just a little bit more.
Go ahead.
This is a really easy place to caricature and to make some generalities, but it is a place that surprises. that offers quirks that are unexplainable, that offers scenery like nothing you'll see this side of Neptune. Extraordinary people, ranging, of course, all up and down the socioeconomic spectrum. I will say I've had a long argument with it. There's parts of it that that are maddening, but there are parts that have a powerful allure. It's to maybe use a cliche, it's like that line from Godfather 3, you know, every time I think I get free, they just keep pulling me back. You know, I just keep getting pulled back to this place, which has been a hurtful place in some ways, but also has been enormously beguiling.
Yeah, well, that doesn't sound like a bad place to end with the Godfather 3. And you do talk about the greed and the bloodstains, the beauty and the hypocrisy and the terror. Those were, as part of the origin story, those were lines that gripped me. Well, thank you, Tom, for that. And the book, again, is Rim to River, Looking into the Heart of Arizona. And this is Paul Starobin with America and Beyond.